Kick the serve over to the back end, he'll slice it short. You can come in behind it at, like, will. Worry about your own guy, Schacht says. Your guy's got zero imagination. And you've got an empty expanse where your stomach ought to be, remember? I am a man with no stomach. They emerge through flaps in the tarp with hands upraised in slight apology to their opponents, walk out onto the warmer courts, the slow, green, eraserish footing of indoor composite. Their ears dilate into all the sounds in the larger space. Gasps, and thwops, and pocks, and sneakers squeaks. Femulus's court is almost down in female territory. Courts 13 to 24 are girls, 18s A and B, all bobbing ponytails, and two-handed backhands, and high-pitched grunts, that if girls could only hear what their own grunts sounded like, they'd cut it out. Femulus can't tell whether the very muffled applause way down up behind the gallery panel is sardonic applause at his finally appearing after several minutes of vomiting, or is sincerely for K.D. Coyle on Court 3, who's just smashed a sucker lob so hard, it's bounced up and racked 3's tray of hanging lights. Except for some rubber in his legs, Femulus feels stomachless, and tentatively okay. This match is an all-out must-win for him in terms of the Whataburger. The infra-lit courts are warm and soft. The heaters bolted into both walls above the tarp's upper hem are the deep warm red of little square suns. The Port Washington players all wear matching socks and shorts and tucked-in shirts. They look sharp, but effete. A mannequinish aspect to them. Most of the higher-ranked ETA students are free to sign on with different companies for no fees but free gear. Coyle is Prince and Reebok, as is Trevor Axford. John Wayne is Dunlop and Adidas. Schacht is Headmaster Styx, but his own clothes and knee supports. Ortho Stice is Wilson and all-black Fila. Keith Freer is Fox Styx, and both Adidas and Reebok until one of the two companies' NNE reps catches on. Trolsch is Spalding, and damn lucky to get that. Howlin' Condensa is Dunlop, and lightweight Nike high tops, and an air stirrup brace for the Dickey ankle. Shaw is Kinex sticks and clothes from Tachani's Big and Tall line. Femulus's entrepreneurial vim has earned him complete freedom of choice and expense, though he's barred by DeLint and Nwangi from shirts that mention the Sinn Féin or that extol Alston, Massachusetts in any way in competition. Before going back to the baseline and warming up ground strokes, Schacht likes to take a little time courtside futzing around, hitting his head's frames against strings and listening for the pitch of best tension, arranging his towel on the back of his chair, making sure his cards aren't still flipped from some previous match, etc. And then, he prefers to sort of snuffle around his baseline for a bit, checking for dust bunnies of ball fuzz and little divots or ridges from cold weather heave, adjusting the brace on his ruined knee, putting his thick arms out, cruciform, and pulling them way back to stretch out the old pecs and cuffs. His opponent waits, patiently, twirling his polybutylene stick. And when they finally start to hit around, the guy's expression is pleasant. Schacht always prefers a pleasant match, one way or the other. He really doesn't care all that much whether he wins anymore, since first the Crohn's and then the knee at 16. He'd probably now describe his desire to win as a preference, nothing more. What's singular is that his tennis seems to have improved slightly in the 2 years since he stopped really caring. It's like his hard flat game stopped having any purpose beyond itself and started feeding on itself and got fuller, looser, its edges less jagged, though everybody else has been improving too, even faster, and Schacht's rank has been steadily declining since 16, and the staff has stopped talking even about a top college ride. Stitz warmed to him, though, since the knee and the loss of any urge beyond the play itself, and treats Schacht now almost more like a peer than an experimental subject with something at stake. Schacht is already in his heart committed to a dental career. and he even interns twice a week for a root specialist over at the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation in East Enfield when not touring. It strikes shocked as odd that Pemulis makes such a big deal of stopping all substances the day before competitive play, but never connects the neurasthenic stomach to any kind of withdrawal or dependence. He'd never say this to Pemulis unless Pemulis asked him directly, but Schacht suspects Pemulis is physically dream-dependent, preludin, or attenuate, or something. It's not his business. Schacht's supposedly French-Canadian guy is as broad as Schacht, but shorter, his face dark, and with a kind of Eskimoid structure to it. At 18, his hairline recessed in the sort of way where you just know the kid's already got hair on his back. And he warms up with crazy spins, Mooney top off a western forehand and weird inside-out shit off a one-hand back. His knees dipping oddly whenever he makes contact, and his follow-through full of the dancerly flourishes that characterize a case of nerves. A nervous spin artist can be eaten more or less for lunch if you hit as hard as Schacht does. And what Pemulis said is true. The guy's backhand is always sliced and lands shallow. Schacht looks over at Pemulis's guy, a grunter with a moody profile and the storky look of recent puberty. Pemulis is looking oddly sanguine and confident after a couple minutes futzing with the cans of water, rinsing out the oral cavity and so on. Pemulis is maybe going to win too, despite himself. Schacht figures he can run in and get one of the 12-year-olds he big buddies to go back into the passage and empty Pemulis's bucket on the sly before anybody coming off court sees it. Evidence of nervous incapacity of any kind gets noted and logged at ETA, and Schacht's observed Pemulis having some kind of vested emotional interest in attending the Whataburger Invitational over Thanksgiving. He thought Mario's lurking around in the cold passage, scratching his poor big head over technical lighting problems, was kind of funny. There will be no lungs, or tarps, or dim passages at the Whataburger. The Tucson tournament is outside, and Tucson cruised around 40 degrees Celsius even in November, and the sun there was a retinal horror show on overheads and serves. Though Schacht buys quarterly urine like the rest of them, it seems to Pemulis that Schacht ingests the occasional chemical that way grown-ups who sometimes forget to finish their cocktails drink liquor, to make a tense but fundamentally okay interior life, interestingly different but no more. No element of relief. A kind of tourism. And Schacht doesn't even have to worry about obsessive training, like ink or Stice, or get sick so often from the physical stress of constant dreams, like Trolch, or suffer from thinly disguised psychological fallout like Ink or Struck or Pemulis himself. The way Pemulis and Trolch and Struck and Axford ingest substances and recover from substances and have a whole jargony argot based around various substances gives Schacht the creeps a bit. But since the knee injury broke and remade him at 16, he's learned to go his own interior way and let others go theirs. Like most very large men, he's getting comfortable early with the fact that his place in the world is very small, and his real impact on other persons even smaller. Which is a big reason he can sometimes forget to finish his portion of a given substance. So interested does he become in the way he's already started to feel. He's one of these people who don't need much, much less, much more. Schacht and his opponent warm up their ground strokes with the fluid economy of years of warming up ground strokes. They take turns feeding each other some volleys at net, and then each take a couple up lobs, hitting loose, easy overheads, slowly adjusting the idle from half speed to three-quarter speed. The knee feels fundamentally all right, springy. Slow indoor composite surfaces do not like Schacht's hard flat game, but they are kind to the knee, which after some days outside on hard cement swells to about the size of a volleyball. Schacht feels blandly happy down here on 9, playing in private, way down past the gallery's panel. There is a nourishing sense of pregnable space in a big indoor club that you never get playing outside, especially playing outside in the cold when the balls feel hard and sullen and come off the stick's strung face with an echoless ping. Here everything cracks and booms. The grunts and shoe squeaks and booming pocks of impact and curses unfolding across the white-on-green plain and echoing off each tarp. Soon they'll all go inside for the winter. Shit will yield and let them inflate the ETA lung over the 16 center courts. It's like a barn raising, Inflation Day. It's communal and fun. And they'll take down the central fences and outdoor night lamps and unbolt all the posts into sections and stack them and store them, and the Testar and ATH SCME guys will come up in vans smoking cigarettes and squinting with weary expertise at tubes of plans in Craftsman Blue. And there'll be one, and sometimes two, ATH SCME helicopters with slings and grappling hooks for the lung's dome and nacelle. And Stitt and DeLint will let the younger ETAs get the infrared indoor heaters out of the same corrugated shed the disassembled fences and lamps will go in. Leafcutter ant or Korean-like armies of 14 and 16-year-olds carrying sections and heaters and Gore-Tex swatches and long halolithiated bulbs, while the 18s get to sit on canvas chairs and kibbutz because they did their leafcutter lung-raising bits at 13 to 16 already. Two Testar guys will supervise Otis P. Lord and all this year's conspicuous tech wonks in mounting the heaters and stringing the lights and running coaxial shunts with ceramic jacks between the pump broom's main breaker and the Sunstrand grid, and booting up the circulation fans and pneumatic hoists. That'll raise the lung to the inflated shape of a distended igloo, 16 quarts in 4 rows of 4, enclosed and warmed by nothing but fibrous Gore-Tex and AC current, and an enormous ATH SCME exhaust flow effectuator that an ATH SCME crew in one of the ATH SCME helicopters will bring in a sling and cable, and mount and secure on the lung's nipply nacelle at the top of the inflating dome. On that first night after inflation, traditionally the fourth Monday of November, all the upper-class 18s so inclined will crank up the infrareds and get high and eat low-lipid microwave pizza and play all night, sweating magnificently, sheltered for the winter atop Enfield's level-headed hill. Schacht stands back in the deuce court and lets his guy warm up his serves. Oddly flat and low margin for a nervous touch artist, Schacht bloops each return up with severe backspin so the balls will roll back to him, and he can serve them back to this guy, also warming up. The warm-up routine has become automatic and requires no attention. Way up on number one, Schacht sees John Wayne just plaster a backhand cross-court. Wayne hits it so hard a little mushroom cloud of green fuzz hangs in the air where ball had met strings. Their cards were too far to read in the sour apple light, but you could tell by the way Port Washington's best boy walked back to the baseline to take the next serve that his ass had already been presented to him. In a lot of junior matches, everything past the fourth game or so is kind of a formality. Both players tend to know the overall score by then, the big picture. They'll have decided who's going to lose. Competitive tennis is largely mental, once you're at a certain plateau of skill and conditioning. Stitt'd say spiritual instead of mental, but as far as Schacht can see, it's the same thing. As Schacht sees it, Stitt's philosophical stance is that to win enough of the time to be considered successful, you have to both care a great deal about it and also not care about it at all.
89.
Schacht does not care enough, probably, anymore, and has met his gradual displacement from ETA's A single squad with an equanimity some ETAs thought was spiritual, and others regarded as the surest sign of dicklessness and burnout. Only one or two people have ever used the word brave in connection with Schacht's radical reconfiguration after the things with the Crohn's disease and knee. Hal and Condenza, who's probably as asymmetrically hobbled on the care-too-much side as Schacht is on the not-enough, privately puts Schacht's laissez-faire down to some interior decline, some doom-gray surrender of his childhood's promise to adult-gray mediocrity, and fears it. But since Schacht is an old friend and a dependable designated driver, and has actually gotten pleasanter to be around since the knee, which Hal prays fervently that the ankle won't start being the size of a volleyball itself at the end of each outdoor day, Hal, in a weird and deeper internal way, almost, somehow, admires and envies the fact that Schacht's stoically committed himself to the oral professions and stopped dreaming of getting to the show after graduation. An air of something other than failure about Schacht's not caring enough, something you can't quite define, the way you can't quite remember a word that you know inside. Hal can't quite feel the contempt for Teddy Schacht's competitive slide. That would be a pretty much natural contempt in one who cared so dreadfully, secretly much. And so the two of them tend to settle for not talking about it. Just as Schacht cheerfully, wordlessly, drives the tow truck on occasions, when the rest of the crew are so incapacitated they have to hold one eye closed even to see an undoubled road, and consents, without protest, to pay retail for clean quarterly urine, and doesn't say a word about Hal's devolution from occasional tourist to subterranean compulsive, substance-wise, with his pump room visits and Visine, even though Schacht deep down believes that the substance compulsion's strange apparent contribution to Hal's irrumpent explosion up the rankings has got to be a temporary thing. But there's like a psychic credit card bill for Hal in the mail somewhere coming, and is sad for him in advance about whatever's surely got to give, eventually. Though it won't be the boards, Hal will murder his boards, and Schacht may well be among those jockeying to sit near him. He'd be the first to admit. On two, Hal now kicks a second serve to the ad court with so much left-handed top on it that it almost kicks up over Port Washington's number two guy's head. It's clearly carnage up there on show courts one and two. Dr. Tavis will be irrepressible. The gallery is barely even applauding Wayne and in Cadenza anymore. At a certain point, it becomes like Romans applauding lions. All the coaches and staff, and PWTA parents and civilians, in the overhead gallery, wear tennis outfits, the high white socks, and tucked-in shirts of people who do not really play. Schacht and his man play. Both Pat Montesian and Gately's AA sponsor like to remind Gately how this new resident, Jeffrey Day, could end up being an invaluable teacher of patience and tolerance for him, Gately, as Ennett House staff. "So then at 46 years of age I came here to learn to live by clichés," is what Day says to Charlotte Treat, right after Randy Lentz asked what time it was, again, at 08:25. "To turn my life and will over to the care of clichés. One day at a time. Easy does it. First things first. Courage is fear that has said its prayers. Ask for help. Thy will, not mine, be done. It works if you work it. Grow or go. Keep coming back." Poor old Charlotte Treat, needle-pointing primly beside him on the old vinyl couch that just came from Goodwill, purses her lips.
"You need to ask for some gratitude."
"Oh, no. But the point is, I've already been fortunate enough to receive gratitude."
Day crosses one leg over the other in a way that inclines his whole little soft body toward her.
"For which, believe you me, I'm grateful. I cultivate gratitude. That's part of the system of clichés I'm here to live by. An attitude of gratitude. A grateful drunk will never drink."
I know the actual cliché is a grateful heart will never drink, but since organs can't properly be said to imbibe, I'm still afflicted with just enough self-will to decline to live by utter non sequiturs, as opposed to just good old clichés,
I'm taking the liberty of light amendment. He gives with this a look like butter wouldn't melt. Albeit, grateful amendment, of course. Charlotte Treat looks over to Gately for some sort of help or staff enforcement of dogma. The poor bitch is clueless. All of them are clueless still. Gately reminds himself that he, too, is probably mostly still clueless, still, even after all these hundreds of days. "I didn't know that I didn't know," is another of the slogans that looks so shallow for a while and then all of a sudden drops off and deepens like the lobster waters off the North Shore. As Gately fidgets his way through daily AM meditation, he always tries to remind himself daily that this is all an Ennett House residency is supposed to do. Buy these poor yutzes some time. Some thin pie slice of abstinent time. Till they can start to get a whiff of what's true and deep. Almost magic under the shallow surface of what they're trying to do. I cultivated assiduously. I do special gratitude exercises at night up there in the room. Gratitude ups, you could call them. Ask Randy over there if I don't do them like clockwork. Diligently. Sedulously.
Well, it's true is all, Treat sniffs. About gratitude.
Everybody else except Gately, lying on the old other couch opposite them, is ignoring this exchange, watching an old interlace cartridge whose tracking is a little messed up, so that staticky stripes eat at the screen's pictures bottom and top. Day is not done talking. Pat M. encourages newer staff to think of residents they'd like to bludgeon to death as valuable teachers of patience, tolerance, self-discipline, restraint. Day is not done talking. One of the exercises is being grateful that life is so much easier now. I used sometimes to think. I used to think in long compound sentences with subordinate clauses and even the odd polysyllable. Now I find I needn't. Now I live by the dictates of macrame samplers ordered from the back page ad of an old Reader's Digest or Saturday Evening Post. Easy does it. Remember to remember. But for the grace of capital G God. Turn it over. Terse. Hard-boiled. Monosyllabic. Good old Norman Rockwell, Paul Harvey wisdom. I walk around with my arms straight out in front of me and recite these cliches in a monotone. No inflection necessary. Could that be one? Could that be added to the cliché pool? No inflection necessary. Too many syllables, probably. Randy Lentz says, I ain't got time for this shit. Poor old Charlotte Treat, all of 9 weeks clean, is trying to look primmer and primmer. She looks again over to Gately, lying on his back, taking up the living room's whole other sofa. One sneaker up on the sofa's square, frayed fabric arm thing, his eyes almost closed. Only staff get to lie on the couches. Denial, Charlotte finally says, is not a river in Egypt.
How's about the both of you shut the fuck up? Says Emil Minty.
Jeffrey, not Jeff, Jeffrey Day, has been at Ennett House 6 days. He came from Roxbury's infamous Dimmock detox, where he was the only white person, which Gately bets must have been broadening for him. Day has a squished, blank, smeared, flat face, one requiring, like, great self-effort to like, and eyes that are just starting to lose the nictitated glaze of early sobriety. Day is a newcomer, and a wreck. A red wine and quaalude man who finally nodded out in late October and put his sob through the window of a Malden sporting goods store, and then got out and proceeded to browse until the finest came and got him. Who taught something horseshit sounding like social historicity or historical sociality at some junior college up the expressway in Medford, and came in saying on his intake he also manned the helm of a scholarly quarterly. Word for word, the house manager had said, manned the helm, and
scholarly. His intake estimated that Dave's been in and out of a blackout for most of the last several years, and his wiring is still, as they say, a bit frayed. His detox at Dimmock, where they barely have the resources to give you a Librium if you start to DT, must have been just real grim, because Jeffrey D. alleges it never happened. Now his story is he just strolled into Ennett House on a lark one day from his home 10 clicks away in Malden, and found the place too hilariously egregulous to want to ever leave. It's the newcomers with some education that are the worst, according to Gene M. They identify their whole selves with their head, and the disease makes its command headquarters in the head.
90.
Day wears chinos of indeterminate hue, brown socks with black shoes, and shirts that Pat Montesian had described in the intake as Eastern European-type Hawaiian shirts. Day's now on the vinyl couch with Charlotte Treat after breakfast in the Ennett House living room, with a few of the other residents that either aren't working or don't have to be at work early, and with Gately, who pulled an all-night dream duty shift out in the front office till 0400, then got temp relieved by Jeanette Fultz, so we could go to work janitoring down at the Shattuck shelter until 0700, then came and hauled ass back up here and took back over so that Jeanette could go off to her N.A. thing with a bunch of N.A. people in what looked like a dune buggy, if the dunes in question were in hell, and is now, Gately, trying to unclench and center himself inside by tracing the cracks in the paint of the living room ceiling with his eyes. Gately often feels a terrible sense of loss, narcotics-wise, in the A.M. still, even after this long clean. His sponsor over at the White Flag Group says some people never get over the loss of what they thought was their one true best friend and lover. They just have to pray daily for acceptance and the brass danglers to move forward through the grief and loss, to wait for time to harden the scab. The sponsor, ferocious Francis G., doesn't give Gately one iota of shit for feeling some negative feelings about it. On the contrary, he commends Gately for his candor in breaking down and crying like a baby and telling him about it early 1 a.m. over the payphone, the sense of loss. It's a myth no one misses it. Their particular substance? Shit. You wouldn't need help if you didn't miss it. You just have to ask for help and, like, turn it over, the loss and pain, to keep coming, show up, pray, ask for help. Gately rubs his eye. Simple advice like this does seem like a lot of cliches. Bay's right about how it seems. Yes, and if Jeffrey Day keeps on steering by the way things seem to him, then he's a dead man for sure. Gately's already watched dozens come through here and leave early and go back out there and then go to jail or die. If Day ever gets lucky and breaks down finally and comes to the front office at night to scream that he can't take it anymore and clutch at Gately's pant cuff and blubber and beg for help at any cost, Gately will get to tell Day the thing is that the cliché directives are a lot more deep and hard to actually do, to try and live by, instead of just say. But he'll only get to say it if Day comes and asks. Personally, Gately gives Jeffrey D. like a month at the outside before he's back tipping his hat to parking meters. Except who is Gately to judge who'll end up getting the gift of the program versus who won't, he needs to remember. He tries to feel like Day is teaching him patience and tolerance. It takes great patience and tolerance not to want to punt the soft little guy out into the Commonwealth Avenue ravine and open up his bunk to somebody that really desperately wants it, the gift. Except who is Gately to think he can know who wants it and who doesn't deep down? Gately's arm is behind his head, up against the sofa's other arm. The old DEC viewer is on to something violent and color-enhanced Gately neither sees nor hears. It was part of his gifts as a burglar. He can sort of turn his attention on and off like a light. Even when he was a resident here, he'd have this prescient housebreaker's ability to screen input, to do sensory triage. It was one reason he'd even been able to stick out his 9 residential months here with 21 other newly detoxed housebreakers, hoods, whores, fired execs, Avon ladies, subway musicians, beer-bloated construction workers, vagrants, indignant car salesmen, bulimic trauma mamas, bunco artists, mincing pillow biters, North End hard guys, pimply kids with electric nose rings, denial-ridden housewives, and etc. All jonesing and head-gaming, and mocus and grieving, and basically whacked out, and producing non-stopping output, 24/7, 365. At some point in here, Day's saying,
"So bring on the lobotomist."
"Bring him on, I say." Except Gately's own counselor, when he was a resident here, Eugenio Martinez, one of the volunteer alumni counselors, a one-eared, former boiler room bunco man, and now a cellular phone retailer, who hooked up with the house under the original founder, guy that didn't even use his first name, and had about 10 years clean, Gene M. did. Eugenio'd lovingly confronted Gately early on about his special burglar's selective attention, and about how it could be dangerous because how can you be sure it's you doing the screening, and not the spider? Gene called the disease the spider, and talked about feeding the spider versus starving the spider, and so on and so forth. Eugenio M. had called Gately into the house manager's back office and said, "What if Don's screening input turned out to be feeding the old spider? And what about an experimental unscreening of input for a while?" Gately had said he'd do his best to try, and had come back out and tried to watch a spot dissum of the Celtics while two resident pillow biters from the Fenway were having this involved conversation about some third fag having to go in and get the skeleton of some kind of fucking rodent removed from inside their butthole.
91.
The unscreening experiment had lasted half an hour. This was right before Gately got his 90-day chip and wasn't exactly wrapped real tight or real tolerant still. And in-house this year is nothing like the freak show it was when Gately went through. Gately has been completely substance-free for 421 days today. Ms. Charlotte Treat, with a carefully made-up ruined face, is watching the viewer's striped shot cartridge while she needlepoints something. Conversation between her and Jeffrey D. has mercifully petered out. Day is scanning the room for somebody else to engage and piss off so he can prove to himself he doesn't fit in here and stay separated off, isolated inside himself, and maybe get them so pissed off there's a beef and he gets bounced out, Day, and it won't be his fault. You can almost hear his disease chewing away inside his head, feeding. Emil Minty, Randy Lentz, and Bruce Green are also in the room, sprawled in spring-shot chairs, lighting one gasper off the end of the last, their postures, the don't-fuck-with-me slouch of the streets, that here makes their body's texture somehow hard to distinguish from that of the chairs. Neil Gunther is sitting at the long table in the doorless dining room that opens out right off the old DEC fold-out TP's pine stand, whitening under her nails, with a manicure pencil amid the remains of something she's eaten that involved serious syrup. Bert F. Smith is also in there, way down by himself at the table's far end, trying to saw at a waffle with a knife and fork attached to the stumps of his wrists with Velcro bands. A long time ago former DMV driver's license examiner, Bert F. Smith is 45 and looks 70. Has almost all white hair that's waxy and yellow from close order smoke, and finally got into Ennett House last month after 9 months stuck in the Cambridge City shelter. Bert F. Smith's story is, he's making his, 50th odd stab at sobriety in AA. Once devoutly RC, Bert F.S. has potentially lethal trouble with faith in a loving God, ever since the RC Church apparently granted his wife an annulment in, B.S. 99 after 15 years of marriage. Then for several years a rooming house drunk, which on Gately's view is about one step up from a homeless person type drunk. Bert F.S. got mugged and beaten half to death in Cambridge on Xmas Eve of last year, and left there to, freeze there, in an alley, in a storm, and ended up losing his hands and feet. Dooney Glenn's been observed telling Bert F.S. things like that there's some new guy coming into the disabled room off Pat's office with Bert F.S., who's without not only hands and feet, but arms and legs and even a head, and who communicates by farting in Morse code. This sally earned Glenn 3 days full house restriction and a week's extra chore for what Jeanette Fultz described in the log as exiv cruelty.
There is a vague intestinal moaning in Gately's right side. Watching Bert F. Smith smoke a Benton and Hedges by holding it between his stumps, with his elbows out like a guy with pruning shears, is an adventure in fucking pathos as far as Gately's concerned. And Jeffrey Day cracks wise about there but for grace. And forget about what it's like trying to watch Bert F. Smith try and light a match. Gately, who's been on live-in staff here 4 months now, believes Charlotte Treat's devotion to needlepoint is suspect. All those needles, in and out of all that thin, sterile white cotton, stretched drum tight in its round frame. The needle makes a kind of thud and squeak when it goes into the cloth. It's not much like the soundless pop and slide of real cook and shoot, but still, she takes such great care. Gately wonders what color he'd call the ceiling if forced to cull it a color. It's not white, and it's not gray. The brown-yellow tones are from high-tar gaspers. A pole hangs up near the ceiling, even this early in the new sober day. Some of the drunks and track jockeys stay up most of the night, joggling their feet and chain-smoking, even though there's no cartridges or music allowed after 100 hours. He has that odd house staffer's knack, Gately, already after 4 months, of seeing everything in both living and dining rooms without really looking. Emil Minty, a hardcore smack addict punk here for reasons nobody can quite yet pin down, is in an old mustard-colored easy chair with his combat boots up on one of the standing ashtrays, which is tilting not quite enough for Gately to tell him to watch out, please. Minty's orange mohawk and the shaved skull around it are starting to grow out brown, which is just not a pleasant sight in the morning at all. The other ashtray on the floor by his chair is full of the ragged little new moons of bitten nails, which has got to mean that the Hester tea that he'd ordered to bed at 02:30 was right back down here in the chair, going at her nails again the second Gately left to mop shit at the shelter. When he's up all night, Gately's stomach gets all tight and acidy, from either all the coffee, maybe, or just staying up. Minty's been on the streets since he was like 16, Gately can tell. He's got that sooty complexion homeless guys get, where the soot has insinuated itself into the dermal layer and thickened, making Minty look somehow upholstered. And the big-armed driver from Leisure Time Ice, the quiet kid, green, a garbage-head, all-substance-type kid, maybe 21, face very slightly smunched in on one side, wears sleeveless khaki shirts, and had lived in a trailer in that apocalyptic Enfield trailer park out near the Alston Spur. Gately likes Green because he seems to have got sense enough to keep his map shut when he's got nothing important to say, which is basically all the time. The tattoo on the kid's right tricep is a spear-pierced heart over the hideous name Mildred Bonk, who, Bruce G. told him, was a ray of living light and a dead ringer for the late lead singer of The Fiends in Human Shape and his dead heart's one love ever, and who took their daughter and left him this summer for some guy that told her he ranched fucking longhorn cows east of Atlantic City, New Jersey. He's got, even by Ennett House standards, major league sleep trouble, Green, and he and Gately play cribbage sometimes in the wee dead hours, a game Gately picked up in jail. Bert F. Smith is now hunched in a meaty coughing fit, his elbows out and his forehead purple. No sign of Hester Thrale, nail-biter, and something Pat calls borderline. Gately can see everything without moving or moving his head or either eye. Also in here is Randy Lentz, who, Lentz is, a small-time organic coat dealer who wears sport coats rolled up over his parlor-tanned forearms, and is always checking his pulse on the inside of his wrists.
It's come out that Lance is of keen interest to both sides of the law because this past May, he'd apparently, all of a sudden, lost all control and holed up all of a sudden in a Charlestown motel and freebased most of a whole 100 grams. He'd been fronted by a suspiciously trusting Brazilian in what Lance didn't know was supposed to have been a DEA sting operation in the South End. Having screwed both sides in what Gately secretly views as a delicious fuck-up, Randy Lentz has, since May, been the most wanted he's probably ever been. He is seedily handsome in the way of pimps and low-level coke dealers, muscular in the MP-ish way that certain guys' muscles look muscular, but can't really lift anything, with complexly gelled hair and the little bird-like head movements of the deeply vain. One forearm's hair has a little hairless patch, which Gately knows well spells knife owner. And if there's one thing Gately's never been able to stomach, it's a knife owner. Little swaggery guys that always queer a square beef and come up off the ground with a knife where you have to get cut to take it away from them. Lenz is teaching Gately reserved politeness to people you pretty much want to beat up on sight. It's pretty obvious to everybody except Pat Montesian, whose odd gullibility in the presence of human sludge, though, Gately needs to try to remember, had been one of the reasons why he himself had got into Ennett House originally. Obvious that Lentz is here mostly just to hide out. He rarely leaves the house except under compulsion, avoids windows, and travels to the nightly required AA, NA meetings, in a disguise that makes him look like Cesar Romero, after a terrible accident. And then, he always wants to walk back to the house solo afterward, which is not encouraged. Lance is now seated low in the northeasternmost corner of an old fake velour love seat he's jammed in the northeasternmost corner of the living room. Randy Lance has a strange compulsive need to be north of everything, and possibly even northeast of everything, and Gately has no clue what it's about, but observes Lance's position routinely for his own interest and files. Lentz's leg, like Ken Urdetti's leg, never stops joggling. Day claims it joggles even worse in sleep. Another gurgle and abdominal chug from Don G. lying there. Charlotte Treat has violently red hair, as in hair the color of like a red crayon. The reason she doesn't have to work an outside menial job is she's got some strain of the virus, or, like, HIV. Former prostitute, reformed. Why do prostitutes, when they get straight, always try and get so prim? It's like long-repressed librarian ambitions come flooding out. Charlotte T. has a cut-rate whore's hard, half-pretty face. Her eyes lassoed with shadow around all four lids. Her also with a case of dermal layers sooty complexion. The riveting thing about Treat is how her cheeks are deeply pitted in these deep trenches that she packs with foundation and tries to cover over with blush, which along with the hair gives her the look of a mean clown. The ghastly wounds in her cheeks look for all the world like somebody got at her with a wood-burning kit at some point in her career path. Gately would rather not know. Don Gately is almost 29, and sober, and just huge, lying there gurgling and inert with a fluttery-eyed smile. One shoulder blade and buttock pooch out over the side of a sofa that sags like a hammock. Gately looks less built than poured, the smooth immovability of an Easter Island statue. It would be nice if intimidating size wasn't one of the major factors in a male alumni getting offered the male live-in staff job here. But there you go. Don G. has a massive square head, made squarer looking by the prince's valiantish haircut he tries to maintain himself in the mirror to save money. Room and board aside, plus the opportunity for service, he makes very little as an Ennett House staffer, and is paying off restitution schedules in three different district courts. He has the fluttery, white-eyed smile now of someone who's holding himself just over the level of doze. Pat Montesian is due in at 0900, and Don G. can't go to bed until she arrives because
The house manager has driven Jennifer Belbin to a court appearance downtown, and he's the only staffer here. Fultz, the female live-in staffer, is at a Narcotics Anonymous convention in Hartford for the long Interdependence Day weekend. Gately personally is not hot on N.A. So many relapses and unhumble returns. So many war stories told with non-disguised bullshit pride. So little emphasis on service or serious message. All these people in leather and metal, preening. Rooms full of randy lenses, all hugging each other, pretending they don't miss the substance. Rampant newcomer fucking. There's a difference between abstinence versus recovery. Gately knows. Except, of course, who's Gately to judge what works for who? He just knows what seems like it works for him today. AA's tough Enfield Brighton love. The White Flag group. Old guys with suspended bellies and white crew cuts and geologic amounts of sober time. The crocodiles that'll take your big square head off if they sense you're getting complacent or chasing tail or forgetting that your life still hangs in the balance every fucking day. White Flag newcomers, so crazed and sick they can't sit and have to pace at the meeting's rear like Gately when he first came. Retired old kindergarten teachers and polyresin slacks and a pince-nez, who bake cookies for the weekly meeting, and relate from behind the podium how they used to blow bartenders at closing for just two more fingers in a paper cup to take home against the morning's needled light. Gately, albeit an oral narcotics man from way back, has committed himself to AA. He drank his fair share, too, he figures, after all. Executive Director Pat Montesian is due in at 0900, and has application interviews with three people, two female and one male, who better be showing up soon, and Gately will answer the door when they don't know enough to just come in and say welcome and get them a cup of coffee if he judges them able to hold it. He'll get them aside and tip them off to be sure to pet Pat Montesian's dogs during the interview. They'll be sprawled all over the front office, sides heaving, writhing and biting at themselves. He'll tell them it's a proved fact that if Pat's dogs like you, you're in. Pat Montesian has directed Gately to tell appliers this, and then if the appliers do actually pet the dogs, two hideous white golden retrievers with superated scabs and skin afflictions, plus one has grand mal epilepsy, it'll betray a level of desperate willingness that Pat says is just about all she goes by, deciding. A nameless cat oozes by on the broad windowsill above the back of the fabric couch. Animals here come and go. Alumni adopt them, or they just disappear. Their fleas tend to remain. Gately's intestines moan. Boston's dawn coming back on the green line this morning was chemically pink, trails of industrial exhaust blowing due north. The nail parings in the ashtray on the floor are, he realizes now, too big to be from fingernails. These bitten arcs are broad and thick and a deep autumnal yellow. He swallows hard. He tells Jeffrey Day how, even if they are just clichés, clichés are A, soothing, and B, remind you of common sense, and C, license the universal assent that drowns out silence, and 4, silence is deadly, pure spider food, if you've got the disease. Gene M. says you can spell the disease D-I-S-E-A-S-E, which sums the basic situation up nicely. Pat has a meeting at the Division of Substance Abuse Services and Government Center at noon she needs to be reminded about. She can't read her own handwriting, which the stroke affected her handwriting. Gately envisions going around having to find out who's biting their fucking toenails in the living room and putting the disgusting toenail bits in the ashtray at, like, 0500. Plus, house regs prohibit bare feet any place downstairs. There's a pale brown water stain on the ceiling, over Day and Treat, the almost exact shape of Florida. Randy Lentz has issues with Jeffrey Day because Day is glib and a teacher at a scholarly journal's helm. This threatens the self-concept of a Randy Lentz that thinks of himself as a kind of hiply sexy artist intellectual. Small-time dealers never conceptualize themselves as just small-time dealers, kind of like whores never do. For occupation, on his intake form, Lentz had put freelance scriptwriter, and he makes a show of that he reads. For the first week here in July, he'd held the books upside down in the northeast corner of whatever room. He had a gigantic medical dictionary he'd haul down and smoke and read until Annie Parrott, the assistant manager, had to tell him not to bring it down anymore because it was fucking with Morris Hanley's mind. At which juncture he quit reading and started talking, making everybody nostalgic for when he just sat there and read. Jeffrey D. has issues with Randy L. also, you can tell. There's a certain way they don't quite look at each other. And so now, of course, they're mashed together in the three-man together, since three guys in one night missed curfew and came in without one normal-sized pupil between them and refused urines and got bounced on the spot, and so Day gets moved up in his first week from the five-man room to the three-man. Seniority comes quick around here. Past Minty, down at the dining room table's end, Bert F. Smith's still coughing, still hunched over, his face a dusky purple.
And Nell G. is behind him, pounding him on the back so it keeps sending him forward over his ashtray.
And he's waving one stump vaguely over his shoulder to try to signal her to quit. Lens and Day. My beef may be brewing. Day'll try to goad Lens into a beef that'll be public enough so he doesn't get hurt, but does get bounced, and then he can leave treatment and go back to Chianti and Lewds and getting assaulted by sidewalks and make out like the relapse is Enid House's fault and never have to confront himself or his disease. To Gately, Day is like a wide-open interactive textbook on the disease. One of Gately's jobs is to keep an eye on what's possibly brewing among residents and let Pat or the manager know and try to smooth things down in advance if possible. The ceiling's color could be called dun, if forced. Someone has farted. No one knows just who. But this isn't like a normal adult place where everybody coolly pretends a fart didn't happen. Here, everybody has to make their little comment. Time is passing. Enid House reeks of passing time. It is the humidity of early sobriety, hanging and palpable. You can hear ticking in clockless rooms here. Gately changes the angle of one sneaker, puts the other arm behind his head. His head has real weight and pressure. Randy Lentz's obsessive compulsions include the need to be north, a fear of discs, a tendency to constantly take his own pulse, a fear of all forms of timepieces, and a need to always know the time with great precision. Day, man, you got the time maybe real quick? Lens. For the third time in half an hour. Patience, tolerance, compassion, self-discipline, restraint. Gately remembers his first 6 months here straight. He'd felt the sharp edge of every second that went by, and the freak show dreams, nightmares beyond the worst DTs you'd ever heard about. A reason for a night shift or staffer in the front office is so somebody's there for the residents to talk at when, not if, when the freak show dreams ratchet them out of bed at like 0300. Nightmares about relapsing and getting high. Not getting high, but having everybody think you're high. Getting high with your alcoholic mom and then killing her with a baseball bat. Whipping the old unit out for a spot urine and starting up and flames coming shooting out. Getting high and bursting into flames. Having a water spout shaped like an enormous tall one suck you up inside. A vehicle explodes in an enhanced bloom of sooty flame on the DEC viewer, its hood up like an old pop tab. Day's making a broad gesture out of checking his watch. Right around 0830, fella. Randy L.'s fine nostrils flare and whiten. He stares straight ahead, eyes narrowed, fingers on his wrist. Day purses his lips, leg joggling. Gately hangs his head over the arm of the sofa and regards Lens,
upside down.
That look on your map there mean anything, Randy? Are you, like, communicating something with that look?
Does anybody maybe know the time a little more exactly is what I'm wondering, Don, since Day doesn't.
Gately checks his own cheap digital, head still hung over the sofa's arm.
I got 08-32-14-15-16, Randy.
Thanks a lot, DG man.
So, and now Day has that same flared look for Lentz.
So we've been over this, friend. Amigo. Sport. You do this all the time with me. Again, I'll say it. I don't have a digital watch. This is a fine old antique watch. It points. A memento of far better days.
It's not a digital watch.
It's not a cesium-based atomic clock. It points with hands. See, Spiro Agnew here has two little arms. They point, they suggest. It's not a sodding stopwatch for life. Lentz, get a watch, am I right?
Why don't you just get a watch, Lentz?
Three people I happen to know of for a fact have offered to get you a watch, and you can pay them back whenever you feel comfortable about poking your nose out and investigating the work world. Get a watch. Obtain a watch. A fine, digital, incredibly wide watch, about 5 times the width of your wrist, so you have to hold it like a falconer. And it treats time like pie.
Easy does it, Charlotte Treat half sings, not looking up from her needle and frame.
Day looks around at her.
I don't believe I was speaking to you in any way, shape, or form.
Lenz stares at him. If you're trying to fuck with me, brother...
He shakes his fine, shiny head.
Big mistake.
Oh, I'm all a tremble. I can barely hold my arm steady to read my watch.
Big, 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 real big mistake.
Peace on earth. Goodwill toward men, says Gately.
Back on his back, smiling at the dun cracked ceiling. He's the one who'd farted.
They returned from Long Island bearing their shields rather than upon them, as they say. John Wayne and Howland Condenza lost only 5 total games between them in singles. The A-doubles had resembled a spatter painting, and the B-teams, especially the Distaffs, had surpassed themselves. The whole PWTA staff and squad had had to sing a really silly song. Coyle and Trulch didn't win, and Teddy Schacht had, incredibly, lost to his squat spin-doctory opponent in 3 sets, despite the kid's debilitating nerves at crucial junctures. The fact that Schacht wasn't all that upset got remarked on by staff. Schacht and a conspicuously energized Jim Trulch rallied for the big win in 18A number 2 dubs, though. Trulch's disconnected microphone mysteriously disappeared from his gear bag during post-double showers, to the rejoicing of all. Pemulis's storky, intense, 2-hands-off-both-sides opponent had gotten weirdly lethargic and then disoriented in the 2nd set after Pemulis had lost the 1st in a tiebreak.
After the kid had delayed play for several minutes, claiming the tennis balls were too pretty to hit, PWTA trainers had conducted him, gently, from the court,
and the Peemster got VD, which is Junior Circuit Argot for a victory by default. The fact that Pemulis hadn't walked around with his chest out recounting the win for any ETA females got remarked on only by Hal and T. Axford. Schacht was in too much knee pain to remark on much of anything, and Stitt had ETA's Barry Loach inject the big purple knee with something that made Schacht's eyes roll up in his head. Then during the post-meet mixer and dance, Pemulis's defaulted opponent ate from the hors d'oeuvres table without using utensils, or at one point even hands, did a disco number when there wasn't any music going, and was finally heard telling the Port Washington headmaster's wife that he'd always wanted to do her from behind. Pemulis spent a lot of time whistling and staring innocently up at the prefab ceiling. The buzz for all the 18s squads was warm, and there were little nozzles of light over your seat that you could either have on to do homework or shut off and sleep. Trulch, left eye ominously nystagmic, pretended to recap the day's match highlights for a subscription audience, speaking earnestly into his fist.
The C-team's Stockhausen was pretending to sing opera. Hal and tall Paul Shaw were each reading an SAT prep guide. A good quarter of the bus was yellow highlighting copies of E.A. Abbott's inescapable at ETA book, Flatland, for either Flotman or Trawoff or Thorpe. An elongated darkness with assorted shapes melted by, plus long gauntlets near exits of tall, interstatish lamps laying down cones of dirty-looking sodium light. The ghastly sodium lamplight made Mario Incandenza happy to be in his little cone of white inside light. Mario sat next to K.D. Coyle, who was kind of mentally slow, especially after a hard loss, and they played rock-paper-scissors for 200 clicks or more, not saying anything, engrossed in trying to locate patterns in each other's rhythms of choices of shapes, which they both decided there weren't any. Two or three upperclassmen in Levy Richardson O'Brien Chawoff's disciplinary lit were slumped over Goncharov's Oblomov, looking very unhappy indeed. Charles Tavis sat way in the back with John Wayne and beamed and spoke nonstop in hushed tones to Wayne as the Canadian stared out the window. DeLint was with the 16s one bus back. He'd been ragging Stice's and Cornspan's asses since their doubles, which it looked like they practically gave away. The bus was Shtitless. Shtit always found a private, mysterious way back, then appeared at dawn drills with DeLint and elaborate workups of everything that had gone wrong the day before. He was particularly shrill and insistent and negative after they'd won something. Shocked had listed to port and didn't respond when hands were waved in front of his face, and Axford and Struck started kibitzing Barry Loach about their knees were feeling punk as well. The luggage rack over everyone's heads bristled with grips and coverless strings, and liniment and tincture of benzoin had been handed out and liberally applied, so the warm air became complexly spiced. Everybody was tired, in a good way.
The homeward ride's camaraderie was marred only by the fact that someone near the back of the bus started the passing around of a Gothic-fonted leaflet offering the kingdom of prehistoric England to the man who could pull Keith Freer out of Bernadette Longley.
Freer had been discovered by pro-rector Mary Esther Thode, more or less X-ing poor Bernadette Longley under an Adidas blanket in the very back seat on the bus trip to the East Coast Clays in Providence in September. And it had been a nasty scene, because there were some basic Academy license rules that it was just unacceptable to flout under the nose of staff. Keith Freer was deeply asleep when the leaflet was getting passed around, but Bernadette Longley wasn't, and when the leaflet hit the front half where all the females now had to sit since September, she buried her face in her hands and flushed even on the back of her pretty neck. And her doubles partner came all the way back to where Jim Struck and Michael Pemulis were sitting and told them in no uncertain terms that somebody on this bus was so immature it was really sad.
92.
Charles Tavis was irrepressible. He did a Pierre Trudeau impression no one except the driver was old enough to laugh at. And the whole mammoth traveling squad, three buses worth, got to stop and have the mega breakfast at Denny's, over next to Empire Waste at like 0030, when they got in. Hal's eldest brother, Oren Incandenza, got out of competitive tennis when Hal was 9 and Mario nearly 11. This was during the period of great pre-experialist upheaval, and the emergence of the fringe CUSP of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, and the tumescence of O-N-A-N-ism. At late 17, Oren was ranked in the low 70s nationally. He was a senior. He was at that awful age for a low 70s player where age 18 and the terminus of a junior career are looming, and either one, you're going to surrender your dreams of the show and go to college and play college tennis, or two, you're going to get your full spectrum of gram-negative and cholera and amoebic dysentery shots and try to eke out some kind of sad diasporic existence on a Eurasian satellite pro tour and try to hop those last few competitive plateaus up to show caliber as an adult, or three, you don't know what you're going to do. And it's often an awful time.
93.
ETA tries to dilute the awfulness a little by letting 8 or 9 postgraduates stay on for 2 years and serve in DeLint's platoon of pro-rectors in exchange for room and board and travel expenses to small, sad satellite tourneys.
94.
And Oren's being directly related to ETA administration, obviously, gave him kind of a lock on a pro-rector appointment, if he wanted it. But a pro-rector's job was only for maybe, at most, a few years, and was regarded as sad and purgatorial. And then, of course, what then? What are you going to do after that, etc.? Oren's decision to attend college pleased his parents a great deal, though Mrs. Avril and Condensa, especially, had gone out of her way to make it clear that whatever Oren decided to do would please them because they stood squarely behind and in full support of him, Oren, and any decision his very best thinking yielded. But they were still in favor of college, privately, you could tell. Oren was clearly not ever going to be a professional-caliber adult tennis player. His competitive peak had come at 13, when he'd gotten to the 14-and-under quarterfinals of the National Clays in Indianapolis, Indiana, and in the quarters had taken a set off the second seed. But starting soon after that, he'd suffered athletically from the same delayed puberty that had compromised his father when himself had been a junior player. And having boys he'd cleaned the clocks of at 12 and 13 become now seemingly overnight mannish and deep-chested and hairy-legged, and starting now to clean Oren's own clock at 14 and 15, this had sucked some kind of competitive afflatus out of him, broken his tennis spirit, Oren, and his USTA ranking had nosedived through 3 years until it leveled off somewhere in the low 70s, which meant that by age 15, he wasn't even qualifying for the major event's main 64-man draw. When ETA opened, his ranking among boys' 18s hovered around 10, and he was relegated to a middle spot on the Academy's B-squad, a mediocrity that sort of becalmed his verve even further. His style was essentially that of a baseliner, a counterpuncher, but without the return of serve or passing shots you need to stand much of a chance against a quality netman. The ETA rap on Oren was that he lobbed well, but too often. He did have a phenomenal lob. He could hug the curve of the dome of the lung, and 3 times out of 4 nail a large-sized coin placed on the opposite baseline. He and Marlon Bain, and 2 or 3 other marginal counterpunching boys at ETA, all had phenomenal lobs, honed through spare PM devoted more and more to eschaton, which, by the most plausible account, a Croatian refugee transfer had brought up from the Palmer Academy to Tampa. Oren was eschaton's first game master at ETA, where in the first eschaton generations, it was mostly marginal and deafflaticized upperclassmen who played. College was the comparatively obvious choice then for Oren, as the time of decision drew nigh. Oblique family pressures aside, as a low-ranked player at ETA, he'd had stiffer academic demands than did those for whom the real show had seemed like a viable goal. And the eschatonology helped a great deal with the math-slash-computer stuff ETA tended to be a bit weak in, both himself and Stitt being, at that point, pretty anti-quantitative. His grades were solid. His board scores weren't going to embarrass anybody. Oren was basically academically sound, especially for a somebody with a top-level competitive sport on his secondary transcript. And you have to understand that mediocrity is relative in a sport like junior tennis. A national ranking of 74 in boys 18 and under singles, while mediocre by the standards of aspiring pros, is enough to make most college coaches' chins shiny. Oren got a couple Pac-10 offers, Big Ten offers. University of New Mexico actually hired a mariachi band that established itself under his dorm room's window 6 nights running, until Mrs. Incandenza got himself to authorize FDV Hard to electrify the fences. Ohio State flew him out to Columbus for such a weekend of prospective orientation that when Oren got back he had to stay in bed for 3 days, drinking Alka-Seltzer with an ice pack on his groin. Caltech offered him an ROTC waiver and AP standing in their elite strategic studies program, after Decade Magazine had run a short interest piece on Orin, and the Croat and Eschaton's applied use of
C:/pink, sub 2.
95.
Orin chose BU, Boston University. Not a tennis power. Not in Caltech's league, academically. Not the sort of place that hires bands or flies you out for Roman orgies of inducement. And only just about 3 clicks down the hill from Commonwealth Avenue, from ETA, west of the bay, around the intersection of Commonwealth and Beacon, Boston. It was kind of a joint Orin Incandenza, Averill Incandenza decision. Orin's moms privately thought it was important for Orin to be away from home, psychologically speaking, but still to be able to come home whenever he wished. She put everything to Orin in terms of worrying that her concern over what'd be best for him psychologically might prompt her to overstep her maternal bounds and speak out of turn or give intrusive advice. According to all her lists and advantage-disadvantage charts, BU was, from every angle, far and away O's best choice. But to keep ever from overstepping or lobbying intrusively, the moms actually, for 6 weeks, would flee any room Orin entered, both hands clapped over her mouth. Orin had this way his face would get when she'd beg him not to let her influence his choice. It was during this period that Orin had characterized the moms to Hal as a kind of contortionist with other people's bodies, which Hal's never been able to forget. Himself, from his own experience, probably thought it'd be better for Orin to get the hell out of Dodge altogether, do something Midwest or pack, but he kept his own counsel. He never had to struggle not to overstep. He probably figured Orin was a big boy. This was 4 years and 30-some released entertainments before himself put his head in a microwave oven, fatally.
Then it turned out Averill's adoptive-slash-half-brother, Charles Tavis, who at this time was back chairing ASA at Throppinghamshire,
turned out to be old Minor Sport Athletic Administration Network friends with Boston University's varsity tennis coach.
96.
Tavis flew down special on Air Canada to set up a meeting between the four of them, Averill and Son, and Tavis and the BU tennis coach. The BU tennis coach was a septuagenaric Ivy League guy, one of those emptily, craggily, handsome old patrician men whose profile looks like it ought to be on a coin, who liked his lads to wear all white and actually, literally, vault the net, win or lose, after matches. Boston University had only had a couple nationally ranked players like ever, and that had been in the AD 1960s, way before this fashion-conscious guy's tenure. And when the coach saw Orin play, he about fell over sideways. Recall how mediocrity is contextual. Boston University's players all hailed, literally, from New England country clubs, and wore ironed shorts and those faggy white tennis sweaters with that blood-colored stripe across the chest, and talked without moving their jaw, and played the sort of stiff and patrician serve and volley game you play if you've had lots of summer lessons and club round robins, but had never ever had to get out there and kill or die. Psychically. Orin wore cut-off jeans and deck sneakers without socks and yawned compulsively as he beat Boston University's immaculately groomed number one singles man, 2-0, hitting something like 40 offensive lobs for winners. Then at the four-way meeting Tavis arranged, the old BU coach showed up in L.L. Bean chinos and a Lacoste polo shirt, and got a look at the size of Orin's left arm, and then at Orin's mom's in a tight black skirt and Levantine jacket with coal around her eyes and a moosed tower of hair, and about fell back over sideways the other way. She had this effect on older men somehow. Orin was in a position to dictate terms limited only by the parameters of BU's own sports budget marginality.
97.
Orin signed a letter of intent accepting a full ride at BU, plus books, and a Hitachi laptop with software, and off-campus housing and living expenses, and a lucrative work-study job where his job was to turn on the sprinklers every morning at the BU football terrier's historic Nickerson Field, sprinklers that were already on automatic timers. The sprinkler job was BU's tennis team's one plum, recruitment-wise. Charles Tavis, who at Averill's urging, had failed to cash in his Canadian return ticket and stayed on as assistant headmaster to assist Oren's father's oversight of the academy.
98.
In a progressively more and more total capacity, as both in and external travels took J.O. Incandenza away from Enfield more and more often, said 3.5 years later that he never really expected a thank you from Oren anyway, for liaisoning with the BU tennis apparatus, that he wasn't in this for the thank yous, that a person who did a service for somebody's gratitude was more like a 2D cutout image of a person than a bona fide person. At least that's what he thought, he said. He said, what did Averill and Hal and Mario think? Was he a genuine 3D person? Was he perhaps just rationalizing away some legitimate hurt? Did Oren maybe resent him for seeming to move in just as he, Oren, moved out? Though surely not for Tavis's assuming more and more total control of the ETA helm, as J.O. Incandenza spent increasingly long hiati, either off with Mario on shoots or editing in his room off the tunnel, or in alcoholic rehabilitative facilities. 13 of them over those final 3 years. Tavis has the Blue Cross statements right here. And even more surely not for the final fellow to say anyone with any kind of denial-free sensitivity could have predicted for the past 3.5 years. But, CT opined, on the 4th of July, YDPAH, after Oren, who now had plenty of free summer time, declined his 5th straight invitation back to Enfield and his family's annual barbecue and Wimbledon finals interlace spontaneous dissemination watching, Oren might just be harboring a resentment over CT moving into the headmaster's office and changing the doors, teo chitere possunt, before himself's microwaved head had even cooled, even if it was to take over a headmaster's job that had been positively keening to have someone sedulous and brisk take over. Incandenza himself, having eliminated his own map on the 1st of April of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, just as spring letters of intent were due from seniors who'd decided to slouch off to college tennis, just as invitations for the European Dirt Circuit Invitationals were pouring in all over lateral Alice Moore's paraboloid desk, just as ETA's tax-exempt status was coming up for review before the MDR exemption panel.
99.
Just as the school was trying to readjust to new ONANTA accreditation procedures after years of USTA accreditation procedures. Just as litigations with Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital over alleged damage from ETA's initial hilltop flattening and with Empire Waste Displacement over the flight paths of concavity-bound displacement vehicles were reaching the appellate stage. Just as applications and fellowships for the fall term were in the final stages of review and response. Well, someone had to come in and fill the void, and that person was going to have to be someone who could achieve total worry without becoming paralyzed by the worry or by the absence of minimal thank yous for inglorious duties discharged in the stead of a person whose replacement was naturally going to come in for some resentment, Tavis felt. Since you can't get mad at a dying man, much less at a dead man, who better to assume the stress of filling in as anger object than that dead man's thankless, inglorious, sedulous, untiring, 3D bureaucratic assistant and replacement, whose own upstairs room was right next to the headmaster's house's master bedroom, and who might, by some grieving parties, be viewed as some kind of interloping usurper. Tavis had been ready for all this stress and more, he told the assembled academy in preparatory remarks before last year's fall term convocation, speaking through amplification from the red and gray bunting-draped crow's nest of Gerhard Stitt's transom down into the rows of folding chairs arranged all along the base and sidelines of ETA courts 6 through 9. He not only fully accepted the stress and resentment, he said he had worked hard and would continue in his dull, quiet, unromantic fashion, to work hard to remain open to it, to this resentment and sense of loss and irreplaceability, even after 4 years, to let everyone who needed to get it out, get it out. The anger and resentment and possible contempt for their own psychological health, since Tavis acknowledged publicly that there was more than enough on every ETA's plate, to begin with, as it was. The convocation assembly was outside, on the center courts that in winter are sheltered by the lung. It was the 31st of August in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, hot and muggy. Upperclassmen who'd heard these same basic remarks for the past 4 years made little razor to jugular and hangman's noose over imaginary crossbeam motions, listening. The sky overhead was glassy blue between clots and strings of clouds moving swiftly north. On courts 30 to 32, the applied music chorus guys kept up a background of Tenebrae Facti Sunt, sotto voce. Everybody had had on the black armbands, everybody still wore for functions and assemblies, to keep from forgetting. And the cotton U.S. and crisp nylon ONAN flags flapped and clanked halfway down the driveway's poles in remembrance. The Sunstrand Plaza still, as of that fall, hadn't yet found a way to muffle its East Newton ATH-SCME fans. And Tavis's voice, which even with the police bullhorn tended to sound distant, and receding anyway, wove in and out of the sound of the fans and the whomp of the EWD catapults and locusts' electric screams and the exhaust-rich hot rush of the summer wind up off Commonwealth Avenue and the car horns and the green lines trundle and clang and the clank of the flags, poles, and wires. And everybody but the staff and littlest kids up front missed most of Tavis's explanation that Salick Laud had nothing to do with the fact that there was simply no way the late headmaster's beloved spouse, an ETA Dean of Academic Affairs and of Females, Mrs. Avril Incandenza, could have become headmaster. How would headmistress have sounded? And she had the females and female prorectors and Hardy's custodians to oversee, and curricula and assignments and schedules, and complex new ONANTA accreditation to finalize the Kafkan application for, plus daily headmaster's house sterilization and personal ablution rituals, and the constant battle against anthracnose and dry climate blight in the dining room's green babies, plus, of course, ETA teaching duties on top of that, with the addition of untold sleepless nights with the militant grammarians of Massachusetts, the academic pack that watchdogged media syntax and invited florid, fish-lipped guys from the French Academy to come speak with trilled R's on prescriptive preservation, and held marathon multi-readings of, for example, Orwell's Politics and the English Language, and whose Avril-chaired Tactical Phalanx, MGMs, was then unsuccessfully, it turned out, court-fighting the new Gentle Administration's Title II-G Public-funded library phase-out fat-trimming initiative, besides, of course, being practically laid out flat with grief and having to do all the emotional processing work attendant on working through that kind of personal trauma, on top of all of which, assuming the administrative tiller of ETA itself, would have been simply an insupportable burden, she's thanked CT effusively on more than one public occasion for leaving the plush sinecure of Throppinghamshire and coming down to undertake the stress-ridden tasks, not only of bureaucratic administration, and ensuring as smooth a transition as possible, but of being there for the Incandenza family itself, with or without thank-yous, and for helping support not only Oren's career and institutional decision processes, but also for being there supportively for all involved when Oren made his seminal choice not to go ahead and play competitive college tennis after all, at Boston University.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.